Stephen F. Rohde is an ACLU of Southern California constitutional lawyer. He's the author of several books, including Freedom of Assembly and A Living History of Our Bill of Rights. He spoke March 23, 2006, at an event sponsored by the Singles Chapter of the ACLU in Los Angeles.
Thank you. It's always a great pleasure to be with the ACLU Singles Chapter. The framework of tonight's talk is an examination of the current president's unprecedented usurpation of executive power. And I want to be able to come to the heart of the current issues facing the country, which were first revealed last December by the New York Times when they broke the story that the president had authorized the National Security Agency, the NSA, to engage in secret, warrantless wiretapping of Americans in the president's war on terror. And I want to examine that carefully because the president and the Attorney General Gonzalez and other spokespersons for the administration so far have done quite a good job of obfuscating that issue, of blurring it in the public mind, and of suppressing any criticism of that program by questioning the patriotism of anybody who goes after it, and of suggesting, why would you not want us to wiretap Al-Qaeda? Which is the administration's refrain every time they've been asked to justify the program. But before I come to that current crisis, I always want to take a few minutes with an audience like this to put this into a historical context. Because it's a big mistake to see this as a single blemish on the beautiful skin of American history. Regrettably, there have been dark chapters in American history where we have lost our way when it comes to civil liberties and human rights. And we can learn a lot of lessons by examining those chapters. We don't have the time to study each one of them, and we can only glance over the details. But I want to try to tease out of them key common elements on the whole question of the role of presidential authority in a constitutional democracy. And that's really the core of what we have to examine tonight. The ink was barely dry on the Bill of Rights in 1798 when Congress passed the Alien and Sedition Acts. Put yourself back to 1798. John Adams is president. Many of the men who wrote the Bill of Rights and wrote the First Amendment were alive and active in the public sphere. And yet, fearing war with France, the President of the United States, and on that occasion with the complicity of Congress, and we will see that sometimes Congress is co-opted in these examples, and sometimes the president acts in defiance or against Congress's will or in the face of a passive Congress. So John Adams, fearing war with France and Congress, passed the Alien and Sedition Acts. The Alien Acts, punishing immigrants, outsiders, non-citizens, if you will, in today's nomenclature, and the Sedition Acts, punishing newspapers, dissenters, editorialists, broadsides that were critical of President Adams and his policies. And what you get right there at the founding is that ugly coupling which is going to pervade this entire history of the xenophobic attack on aliens, outsiders, the other, immigrants on one side, and suppression of free speech, sedition, on the other hand. And we will see that time and time again down through the years. Scores of men and women were arrested, charged, and punished during that period. Now, the Alien and Sedition Acts expired by their own terms on the last day of John Adams' administration. So that when Thomas Jefferson took office, there were no Alien and Sedition Acts. Now, that's a good thing, but it shows the politics of this, because now there were no Sedition Acts to punish Adams and his confreres in their criticism of Thomas Jefferson. And Jefferson is not blameless in this. If you read some of the deeper histories, he supported libel suits against many of his own critics as well. It's sad when you get to study American history in some depth and all the fallen heroes that are collected by the wayside when we get past the glamorous images that are so often taught to our children. We come down then to the Civil War, and another example of what I just said. This time, that great President Abraham Lincoln, held up as a great friend of liberty and freedom, now fearing for national security, for the nation, for the Union, President Abraham Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus. No congressional approval, only the executive decision of a president in a time of war. The writ of habeas corpus, borrowed from English law, it is the right of a person to come back to court, the corpus to have their body, alive hopefully, brought to a court to challenge their incarceration, to challenge their detention, even if all their appeals have been exhausted. And so the writ of habeas corpus was critical to the founders. The tyranny they had thrown off, as they cataloged in the Declaration of Independence, spoke of the lawless acts of the king and the derogation of the writ of habeas corpus. So important was the writ of habeas corpus that it was put into the text of the U.S. Constitution directly, not in the Bill of Rights. We know that the Bill of Rights were the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, but the writ of habeas corpus was written into the body of the Constitution, and it was written into the article having to do with the Congress and the legislature, and it said that it shall not be suspended except in time of war or insurrection, but that was a power reserved to Congress to lift the writ of habeas corpus, not the president. And yet, fearing for what we would call national security, President Abraham Lincoln repeatedly lifted and suspended the writ of habeas corpus, sending into incarceration anyone who disagreed with the president's policies, at that time the Union. So you had Confederates and sympathizers of the Confederacy sent to jail. And this will sound familiar: without lawyers, without charges, incommunicado, and without the right of habeas corpus. We come down to World War I, another dark chapter, wartime, fear of the aliens, fear of anarchists, dissidents, and the country was swept up in the Red Scare. And then we had an Attorney General Mitchell Palmer and the terrible Palmer raids, when in the early days of 1919, a young director of a new agency that would become known as the FBI, a young J. Edgar Hoover, in 1919, was in charge of rounding up dissidents, dissenters, anarchists across the country in the infamous Palmer raids. And it was in that time that the Espionage and Sedition Acts were passed to suppress any dissent of that war. And across the country, people were jailed for what they said. No lesser a figure than Eugene Debs, great socialist leader, candidate for president, was convicted under the Espionage and Sedition Acts and sent to jail for 10 years for giving a speech in Canton, Ohio, that was far less seditious than the speech I'm giving right now. And his case went, by the way, if you didn't sign in, it's okay. We'll get the list from the FBI after the meeting. And Eugene Debs' case went to the United States Supreme Court. Now, remarkably, the United States Supreme Court, until 1919, had never addressed the First Amendment. There were no First Amendment cases that had gone to the United States Supreme Court. And it fell to that great jurist, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. And I'll burst another bubble here because in the early part of 1919, when the Debs case, in a triumvirate of cases known as Schenck and Froework and Debs, went to the United States Supreme Court, that liberal justice led the court in a unanimous opinion, upholding the conviction of Eugene Debs and upholding the convictions of the others in that group of cases. And it's there that Oliver Wendell Holmes coined two phrases. One was speech that poses a clear and present danger may be punished. And the oft-misquoted cocktail party phrase, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. Misquoted because even what Oliver Wendell Holmes said was you cannot falsely yell fire in a crowded theater and cause a panic. False speech having an immediate impact, often misquoted even by judges. And so it was that Oliver Wendell Holmes upheld those convictions. Holmes, a veteran of the Civil War, wounded three times, could not accept the fact that young men were dying on the battlefields of Europe while people safely at home like Eugene Debs could be giving speeches undermining the war effort. But Oliver Wendell Holmes that year, 1919, went through an extraordinary transformation in his thinking. This itself, that single year in the history of our court and our country, would be worth an entire evening's lecture. I've actually written a play set in Oliver Wendell Holmes' study in Washington, D.C., because what happened over that year was he met with Felix Frankfurter, a professor of law at Harvard University, Howard Lasky, Zachariah Chafee, one of the earliest visionaries of what a true First Amendment could be. These were men, they weren't at the founding of the First Amendment, but they were at the founding of the Supreme Court's interpretation of the First Amendment. And by talking and visiting with Holmes, who had a summer home in Massachusetts, by the fall of 1919, Holmes' view had been transformed. And the case of Abrams came to the Supreme Court. The Abrams case, a group of Jewish anarchists who printed a pamphlet, half one side in English, the other side in Yiddish, threw these anonymous pamphlets out of factories on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, calling on the government not to intervene in the Bolshevik Revolution that was transpiring at that time. Yet the Abrams defendants were captured, indicted, charged, convicted, sentenced to jail, and that case went to the United States Supreme Court and got there in the fall of 1919. And although the majority of the Supreme Court saw it easily, all they did was quote Oliver Wendell Holmes from the Debs case earlier that year, Holmes and his protege, Louis Brandeis, the first Jew on the United States Supreme Court, dissented in the Abrams case. Now Holmes said that in time of war and national crisis, we need the protection of the First Amendment even more than we need it in times of peace and tranquility. That in times of crisis is when the public would be most inflamed, most irrational, most likely to suppress dissent in the name of patriotism and falling into line behind the war effort. And Holmes and Brandeis wrote a dissent in Abrams that was the kernel of First Amendment jurisprudence as we know it today. It would take 50 years till 1969 in the Brandenburg case for a majority of the Supreme Court to adopt their view. Yet, by that time in 1919, lives were destroyed, people were sent to jail, journalists were punished, and we had another dark chapter in American history. Then we come down to perhaps putting slavery aside, perhaps the darkest chapter in this context during World War II. Within the memory and young lives of some of the people in this room, again, a unilateral presidential order by Franklin Delano Roosevelt establishing internment camps and sending upwards of 120,000 Japanese Americans, torn from their homes and offices, sent into camps, Manzanar and elsewhere. No crime, no charges, no lawyers. Nothing more than their heritage and their ethnicity marked them for incarceration without any remedy. Two-thirds of the 120,000 Japanese Americans were American citizens. Why do I tell you that? Not because the rights of the other third who were not American citizens were not violated. The Constitution protects the rights of persons in the United States, citizens and non-citizens, documented and undocumented human beings. John Ashcroft, in his tenure, tried to suggest to the American people that they were safe because they were citizens. And the American Constitution protects citizens. But that was a shrunken view of the Constitution. It protects citizens and non-citizens. So it was the rights of every one of those 120,000 people that were violated in that internment. But I make the point, because when a government starts to move against its people, when it moves against the most vulnerable, the marginalized, the least able to protect itself and get away with it, it will move against its own citizens. And you are not safe, and you cannot sit idly by as the rights of others are violated. And there's no better and terrible example of that than the internment of Japanese Americans. And again, the United States Supreme Court upheld the internment of the Japanese in the wonderful, not wonderful, he was wonderful, Fred Korematsu case, a hero who we lost last year, Fred Korematsu, who challenged the internment. And when the case came to the United States Supreme Court, the Justice Department parroted the information they had been given by the U.S. military, and they told the court that Japanese Americans posed a clear and present danger, that the military had evidence of their espionage and their infiltration and their danger to America. The Justice Department repeated without examination those accusations, and the Supreme Court accepted them at face value and deferred to the military, deferred to the President of the United States. and upheld the internment program. It would take 40 years for a special commission to be appointed by Gerald Ford to re-examine the internment of the Japanese. And that commission identified three and only three reasons for the internment. No military necessity. They found that the military had lied to the Justice Department, that the Justice Department had carried those lies to the United States Supreme Court, that all of that threat had been exaggerated. Every time I'm speaking, think about today, that military threat had been exaggerated, and the commission found that the internment of the Japanese was due to three things: racism, war hysteria, and a failure of political leadership. Let's remember: racism, war hysteria, and a failure of political leadership. And then we come down to the period of McCarthyism, and we come down to now the growth of the FBI. Remember that young, eager director of the nascent FBI in 1919. Now he is J. Edgar Hoover, embedded in Washington, administration after administration, fearful that they couldn't remove him because he had a file on every president. And it was J. Edgar Hoover that launched COINTELPRO and the infiltration and surveillance of domestic, religious, and political organization, the infiltration of Martin Luther King's organization, the infiltration of anti-war groups. And it was in that period that we would later have all of the infamy of Richard Nixon and the violations of civil liberties, which led to the appointment of the Church Commission to examine exactly what had been done in that era in the name of national security. And the Church Commission plays a critical role as we now move into the current era. What do we learn from all those dark and shameful chapters in American history? We learn that faced with a crisis, foreign and domestic, real or imagined, the executive will seize and seize and seize as much power as the other branches of government, and the people will allow the executive to seize. And that the power of the executive is not bound by the paper parchment of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Eventually and ultimately, it is bound by the will of the people, by the expression of that will through their elected officials, by the turning out of office of elected officials who do not express that will, and on some cases, by the last resort of the courts of our country. It's emblematic that in those periods, the balance of individual rights and security are tipped entirely in favor of security, that the privacy that generally is accorded to the individual and the openness that is expected of government are entirely reversed, so that it is the government that operates in secret, and it is the people's privacy that is exposed to the government. Those are lessons we have got to learn and remember. And the last is that all too often we see these violations occurring. They were seen at the time. People live their lives in Los Angeles, as their brothers and sisters in the Japanese American community were removed from their businesses, removed from their streets and neighborhoods, and for the rest of the community, life went on. And it would take years in each case, it would take generations to look back and see the shame and the danger that had been administered to our constitutional democracy. And I'm going to ask you right now whether we are going to live through another shameful and dark chapter of American history, where we leave it to our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren and scholars and commissions of the future to look back and wring their hands and ask, what were the American people doing in the post-9/11 era? What was the opposition political party doing in the post-9/11 era? How did this happen? And I have told some of you that 3 years ago, I had my first granddaughter, Lexi. And it comes as a surprise to my friends that 2 months ago, I had my second grandchild, Charlie. And I personally have rededicated this work to Lexi and Charlie, to all the Lexis and Charlies of this country, to all the Lexis and Charlies of this world. Because your Lexi and your Charlie is going to ask you someday, what did you do? What did you do when Muslims were being rounded up and detained illegally? What did you do when America was torturing in Guantanamo Bay and in Abu Ghraib and having black sites where the CIA, we don't even know of the locations where they are torturing, detaining, interrogating, and in 100 examples that have been unearthed, killing prisoners in the name of spreading democracy and freedom around the world? That is the challenge. So let me come to this NSA spying scandal, put it in a very clear, specific context, because I want each one of you to be an ambassador of the Bill of Rights. I want you to take this information tomorrow and talk to your friends and families about it. I have a wonderful friend, Father Chris Ponet, a Catholic priest who coined the phrase resistance at the water cooler. That beautiful metaphor. I don't know how many people have water coolers. Maybe resistance at Starbucks is better. It means that for those folks who have barely scratched the surface, you are here tonight. You saw this topic. I know many of you. You have come. You have educated yourselves. You've gotten past Fox News and CNN and the networks. You've accessed information to understand what is going on, and you're here tonight eager to get even more information. So I appoint you as ambassadors of the Bill of Rights to talk about this at the water cooler, at Starbucks, at the dinner table, and with your family and friends. You don't have to be a constitutional lawyer to understand the 4 or 5 principles of why what the government is doing today is patently illegal and unconstitutional. 1968, a kind of snapshot of where the law was. In 1968, there were laws having to do with collecting foreign intelligence, eavesdropping, surveillance, and the like, and we had laws of that kind in 1968. And those laws contained a provision which said, in 1968, nothing contained in this chapter or in Section 605 of the Communications Act, shall limit the constitutional power of the president to take such measures as he deems necessary to protect the nation against actual or potential attack or other hostile acts of a foreign power to obtain foreign intelligence information deemed essential to the security of the United States or to protect national security information against foreign intelligence activities. Woe that President Bush had that law today, because that is the claim of unrestrained, unrestricted, boundless presidential authority over foreign intelligence and foreign surveillance, which the president would have you believe he enjoys today. To do that, he is amnesiac for the period from 1968 to the present, because the developments in our law are extraordinary and clear and irrefutable in that period. We had the abuses of Nixon, we had COINTELPRO, we had the Church Commission in the early 70s, and we got the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, F-I-S-A. And FISA was a serious piece of legislation debated by the Congress and passed. It provided for the creation of a new court because there never had been judges involved in the issuance of secret surveillance and eavesdropping and wiretapping. So a remedy to the abuses of Nixon in the 60s was the creation of the FISA court, a secret court meeting in Washington, judges appointed by the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, FISA is no creation of the ACLU. FISA was extremely indulgent toward the FBI and toward the applications that came before it for secret wiretaps. We know that over the time since 1978, when FISA took effect, there have been over 18,800 applications from the FBI for secret wiretap and eavesdropping search warrants. The court has rejected 5. So, generally speaking, there's no problem with the government going to FISA and getting one of these search warrants. And the notion today that General Gonzales can say that we couldn't go to FISA, we couldn't take the time to go to FISA, we couldn't jump through the hoops of FISA is a complete figment of his imagination. Now, FISA contained other provisions and was quite far-sighted. And what we talk about in this area is, has Congress occupied the field? Have they exercised congressional authority in place of presidential authority? And they have. FISA has a provision that in the case of a declaration of war, there can be warrantless searches for a 15-day period. And the legislative history shows that that was an opportunity for the administration to go to Congress to get expanded powers in time of war. Also, FISA provides that there can be warrantless searches for a period of 72 hours, and then the administration can come back to FISA to get a retroactive authority and approval and proceed forward with FISA approval. So FISA contemplated war. FISA contemplated the need for an emergency where the ability to wiretap or surveil was so imminent and immediate that you needed to act. without going to the FISA court. And by the way, these FISA judges work 24/7. There are FISA judges appointed and available at every hour of the day and night. There's a story of the FBI driving up while one of the FISA judges was mowing his lawn, and they gave him the papers and he signed a search warrant. So this is a court that is imminently available to the administration and even had provisions in time of emergency. And more than all that, the FISA Act repealed the provision I read you of sweeping presidential power. It repealed that section. It replaced it with FISA. It replaced it with a provision that says that FISA and a related criminal statute are the exclusive means by which foreign intelligence, surveillance, and wiretapping can be conducted. And to put teeth in it, it made it a crime, a federal crime, to violate FISA and to engage in warrantless wiretaps and eavesdropping without complying with FISA. Every member of the NSA, every lawyer of the Justice Department, every lawyer of the Office of Counsel, and every leader to and including the president have violated FISA and, in my view, are liable under the statute that makes it a crime to violate FISA. Now, the courts have held you can't charge a sitting president with a crime. The only remedy is impeachment. The violation of FISA, in my view, ladies and gentlemen, is an impeachable offense. It is a high crime and misdemeanor in direct violation of the laws of this country, in direct violation of the oath of office of the president to faithfully uphold and enforce the laws of the United States of America. And if you didn't think lying us into war was an impeachable offense, and if you didn't think authorizing torture was an impeachable offense, and if you did not think the illegal detention of American citizens and non-citizens was an impeachable offense, then the violation of a federal statute by launching a sweeping program of surveilling and eavesdropping on Americans in this country is an impeachable offense. Now, the government, faced with all of that history, and I think it's plain when you have a statute that gave the president the kind of sweeping powers he now claims, and that statute is revoked and repealed and replaced with a very careful statutory scheme, that there is no leg to stand on, that there is no escape except the escape of demagoguery and the escape of patriotism and the escape of war hysteria. The one final argument the government has offered lately is that the FISA law says that this is the law that applies absent any other law, and the president and Gonzalez and the others have said, aha, if our presidential authority isn't enough, and if we're expected to operate under FISA, then we have another law that allowed for domestic surveillance and eavesdropping of Americans. It was the force resolution passed by Congress on September 14, 2001, authorizing the use of force to go after terrorists in Afghanistan in the wake of 9/11. And they are invoking a resolution passed to authorize the president to take military action overseas against Al-Qaeda and terrorists as if it was a implicit amendment to FISA to allow for the domestic spying on Americans. Not one congressperson of either party has said they voted for the force resolution thinking they were amending FISA to allow for domestic wiretapping and surveillance. Yet that is what Attorney General Gonzalez, with a straight face, told the Senate Judiciary Committee in the one and only public hearing that has ever been held when Attorney General Gonzalez was given the excuse of not being put under oath for his testimony. That is the administration's case. Early on, before he got his proper briefing, Attorney General Ashcroft was asked, why didn't you go to Congress? You went to Congress in the Patriot Act, offered up in the wake of 9/11, with vast changes in federal criminal law, with vast changes in the FISA Act. But you didn't ask for authority to engage in warrantless wiretapping in America. And I swear, Gonzalez said, when the NSA was revealed last December, Gonzalez said, we didn't go to Congress because we talked to some of the leadership and they said the proposals we had wouldn't get passed. What does that tell you? That they couldn't get the law passed through the constitutional democracy you and I are expected to live under, through the laws you and I are expected to live under, yet they went around the law knowing they couldn't get amendments for this kind of sweeping program passed, and they did it secretly and behind the scenes. Now, what do we know about the program? Very little. The administration has refused to disclose any operational details. People like James Risen of the New York Times, who's published an extraordinary new book, he broke the story on this. He suggests that the NSA, this is no longer FBI agents loosening their ties and sitting with cups of cold coffee in your basement, listening to tape recorders and tapping your phone. No, that's your father's FBI. This is the 21st century FBI and NSA. They've got robotic electronic surveillance equipment, which is operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They have coerced the cooperation of AT&T and all private telephone companies. Today, most international phone traffic passes through 5 or 6 cable systems residing in the United States of America. And with the voluntary, coerced, or otherwise obtained cooperation of AT&T and the other telephone systems, the NSA has the capacity to essentially scan all electronic signals, telephones, emails, etc., to use a sophisticated system of keywords, names, sounds, to capture those conversations and communications. The government has said that all they are doing is capturing conversations with Al-Qaeda and someone in the United States. Now, the Al-Qaeda piece began to unravel when the details of the program were more examined, because the FBI put out a 42-page white paper trying to justify this program. It turns out it refers to Al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups, or those associated with them, or those affiliated with them, or those suspected to be affiliated or aided or related or associated with them. Now, for a government that sent 600 people to Guantanamo Bay, labeling them enemy combatants, and for a government that rounded up 1,200 Muslims after 9/11, and eventually none of them, none as in zero, were charged with any crimes relating to terrorism, let alone any association with 9/11. Some of them were charged with credit card crimes, and many of them, if not all of them, were out of status. This means they hadn't sent in their change of address card. They had overstayed their visa. Millions of people are out of status in America. But the government after 9/11 prioritized people from Middle Eastern, South, and Central Asian and other predominantly Muslim countries and rounded them up and deported them. So for a government that accused 1,200 people of being associated with terrorism, of whom none were, and a government that put 600 people in Guantanamo Bay, and we barely are learning enough about them, but we do know that hundreds of them have been released from Guantanamo Bay, and according to one report, 87% of those sent to Guantanamo Bay were purchased from warlords who captured them mostly in Pakistan, not in Afghanistan, and sold them to coalition forces who then shipped them to Guantanamo Bay, and they were guilty of nothing, not just not guilty of terrorism. They hadn't taken up arms against the United States. So for a government that can so freely label them as enemy combatants and can so freely label the 1,200 as terrorists, and as we can begin to piece together the information and see that they are none in none of those categories, I seriously doubt how careful the NSA is being in ensuring that the foreign party to a telephone communication that is being tapped is a card-carrying member of Al-Qaeda. That is the program. The American Civil Liberties Union, the Center for Constitutional Rights, have filed lawsuits against the program. A third lawsuit was filed by the Electronic Frontier Foundation against AT&T, a class action. You violated your service agreement with your customers by cooperating in this program. You violated federal law. You violated FISA because you were at least complicit in the use of warrantless surveillance in violation of FISA, and there are civil penalties in FISA of $1,000 a day for the violation of anyone's rights under FISA. And that's the case that they are going after. But if any of you listened to Amy Goodman this morning, you heard the story of a lawyer, Thomas Nelson, in Oregon, who believed his home and office were physically searched. U.S. News and World Report this week has broken the story that the Bush administration may have authorized government agents to perform physical searches without warrants. What's emerging is the Patriot Act debate was an entire shell game. We're over here fighting over sneak and peek searches and Section 215 and library records, a battle we rightfully should mount and should continue to mount. The government's acting entirely outside of the Patriot Act. They don't even care about getting search warrants. They don't even care if this is true, not only invading your telephone lines, but a private attorney who represented some alleged terrorists, including Brandon Mayfield. Hands, who is Brandon Mayfield? Anyone? Maybe not his name. Now we'll get it. A lawyer in Portland, Oregon, accused of being implicated in the Madrid train bombing. With great fanfare, the FBI, as they always do, said, "We got our man." Brandon Mayfield, and get this, a convert to Islam. His fingerprints were found on backpacks and materials associated with the Madrid bombing. His home and his office were secretly searched. We thought, under the Patriot Act, maybe with no warrant at all. He was held for 2 weeks in jail. He was called a terrorist. The FBI told the press that they had absolute match for his fingerprints, absolutely incontrovertible match of his fingerprints. And if that wasn't enough, the FBI called a press conference and said they found Spanish documents in Brandon Mayfield's home, only to learn it was his children's homework. I kid you not. From Spanish class, these were characterized as Spanish documents found in his home. The FBI released him. The Spanish police sent immediately information questioning the FBI fingerprints. The Spanish police finally, I'm going to say fingered, I guess, the correct suspect in Morocco. Four FBI agents certified they were Brandon Mayfield's fingerprints. And a private forensic society, an independent society that sets the standards of ethics and procedures for fingerprint analysis in America, did an independent study. They found that these were grossly incorrect fingerprint identifications, and that in each case, when the initial reports were negative, the agents in charge told those fingerprint analysts to go back and do a better job. And they came back like lapdogs with exactly the results their handlers requested. Positive, irrefutable identification, later proven wrong. 100% wrong. The FBI apologized to Brandon Mayfield. Brandon Mayfield has filed 3 lawsuits against the FBI and has made the allegation that this was racial profiling, that his status as a Muslim heightened the FBI's willingness to target him. And now Brandon Mayfield's lawyer, Mr. Nelson, has filed a lawsuit believing that his home and office were violated and surveilled and searched, and it's the same Thomas Nelson who is representing the Electronic Frontier Foundation against AT&T in the NSA lawsuit. So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. That's, in my view, an accurate, you can test every proposition I've offered you today. These are the statutes. These are the legal and constitutional principles. This was a power grab in 2001 when the NSA program was launched. When it was first revealed by the New York Times, the administration's first reaction was to condemn the New York Times for its leak in violation of the protections of our society. And then we learned that a group of Democrats were co-opted into this program, that Jane Harman, Rockefeller, and others, eight others, were told about the program, were sworn to secrecy, were not allowed to take notes, were not allowed to talk to legal experts, were not allowed to talk to their aides. They were co-opted so President Bush in January could say this program had bipartisan oversight. And now, Congress, in the DeWine bill, is seeking to bless retroactively, to ratify and approve everything I have described that the NSA is doing, even though Congress has no idea what the NSA is doing. But the Republican-controlled Senate and House are seeking legislation which would totally approve what had happened in the past and, with a little bit of window dressing, would allow it to continue in the future. So I come back to where I was after our historical discussion. What are we going to do about it? Are we going to go about our nice lives aware? You cannot plead ignorance anymore. Aware of this happening. And that's why I've asked audiences like this every time I've spoken, over 150 times since 9/11, at mosques and churches and synagogues and ACLU meetings and colleges and universities, to ask an audience like this to take the $1 1 hour pledge. 1 hour a day. You're going to get a lot of credit tonight for these hours. 1 hour. Get past the news. Get past the flack that the administration offers up. Study what's going on. Research. Talk to others. Organize and take action. Write a letter to the editor. Your letter may not get published, but newspapers publish letters in rough proportion to the ones they get. You write a letter, someone else's letter with a similar thought will get published. Write to your elected officials. Ask them why. This country and its leadership are not up in arms that this president has taken to himself the power to secretly wiretap Americans and take the $1 a day pledge, to put that dollar with any organization you respect that's fighting this fight, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the American Civil Liberties Union, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, BORDC.org, a wonderful group of grassroots activists who got the idea to go to the town council of Amherst and the town council of Northampton and ask them to pass a resolution against the Patriot Act. And that little group, smaller than this audience, has grown to a vast nationwide network of grassroots activists, BORDC.org. 400 resolutions have passed, including our own city and last month our own state legislature, condemning the unwarranted provisions of the Patriot Act. A dollar a day, $365. Times the people in this room, or more if you can afford it. Isn't liberty and justice worth it? Or will we have to remember the words that have been variously attributed to Thomas Jefferson and to Benjamin Franklin? A society that will trade a little liberty for a little security deserves neither and will lose both. Thank you very much.
This was produced by the LA Sound Posse and may be freely copied and distributed. You can visit us on the web at lasoundposse.org.